Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is so great to see you all here this afternoon in such a large number. I'm thrilled to welcome you to the Bronfman Building here at the Desotel Faculty of Management. My name is Anita Novak, and I'm the Integrating Director of the Social Economy Initiative, and I'm delighted to be co-hosting this evening's event with the Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences. There's a little bit of a backstory, actually, about how this event came to be. The director of development at MAC campus, Paul Simard, and I are Facebook friends. We were neighbors when we both worked in this building, and we hadn't really ever spoken. Well, we had spoken, but we hadn't had long discussions. But as Facebook friends, we recognized that we have the same sort of political and social orientation, and we developed Facebook crushes on each other. And he was asking me, you know, what are you reading lately? And I said, oh, I'm reading this great book, Sacred Economics. He's like, no, I'm reading that too. So we said, you know, wouldn't it be cool to bring Charles to Montreal? And I said, yeah, can we do that? So he said, well, I don't know, I'm going to write to him. So he actually wrote to Charles, and Charles checks his own emails and was happy to accept the invitation to come this evening. So that's how that came to be. I want to tell you a little bit about the Social Economy Initiative. Basically, it is the goal is to integrate social entrepreneurship and social innovation into the faculty's teaching, research, and outreach. Just curious, by show of hands, who knows what social entrepreneurship is, like well enough to be able to define it? Okay, so that's a critical mass, but there's still some hands that weren't up. So just that we're all on the same page, we know what traditional entrepreneurship is, right? So somebody has an idea for a business to sell product or a service on the marketplace to turn a profit. Well, the same kind of skills that an entrepreneur uses to have a successful business, a social entrepreneur uses. But instead of trying to sell product and services on the market for profit, they're trying to address a social problem. But they use the same kind of tenacity and all the kinds of skills that a traditional entrepreneur would do. And I had the distinct pleasure and privilege of teaching the first ever course on, it was called Introduction to Social Entrepreneurship and Social Innovation here in the faculty. And the students from the class actually started their own social entrepreneurship Facebook page, which I'll tell you about in a second. But if you want to join the Social Economy Initiative Facebook group, feel free to join here. We're going to call it up. This is we had Mary Gordon last fall speak. There's lots of things going on to hear more about it, so please like us. I want to also plug an event that's happening on April 16th that you do not want to miss. It's the inaugural flagship event that the Social Economy Initiative will be hosting, and these are our keynote speakers going to be talking about the strengths of the social economy. There's a registration available. The invitations are floating around. It's going to be in the faculty club with a limited space, so if you are interested, please register early. In terms of tonight's agenda, after I've introduced an alum from my class who is going to formally introduce Charles, Charles will speak for about half an hour, maybe 40 minutes, and then we'll open up to Q&A. I just want to let everybody know that there are two mics set up, and we are live on webcast through the development office here at McGill, and this is going to be posted to Canal Savoir. It's a Quebec TV station, so just know that if you are camera shy. I also maybe would take this moment to invite you to shut off your cell phones if you haven't already done so. So now I'd like to welcome Michael Hibbert up to the stage to introduce Charles Eisenstein. Mike is a fourth-year BCom student and alumnus from my course. He's currently writing his first book, Guardians in the Cosmos, and recently founded Seeds of Conscious Capitalism. In his words, it's an organization that aims to embed empathic action and sustainability into the economy. And if you want to join their Facebook page, formerly known as Social Entrepreneurship and now Seeds of Conscious Capitalism, here's where you would go. And ladies and gentlemen, I welcome Mike Hibbert.
Here I am. So first of all, thanks to Anita for asking me to say a few words. Supposedly, in introducing Charles, I'm supposed to tell you who Charles is. And as you can imagine, that's an extremely difficult task. And I'll make an attempt at this, but I think what's more important is that I take a moment to tell you who Charles is to me. And I want to do that for two reasons. The first is that it's not every day that I get the opportunity to say how much I appreciate and respect someone without them having the opportunity to interrupt me. And the second reason is that I think for me to stand here before you today and not express to you the impact his work has had on me would be to do you all a huge disservice. I should add that as the third youngest of nine kids, I've grown up with the belief that I should only speak up if I ever really have something to say. From what I've learned, we are, in a scientific sense, stardust. In a spiritual sense, we are the life force power of the universe. Now, standing up here today and introducing Charles is something of a mystical experience to me. My life, in fact, is something of a mystical experience, but this in particular. I first learned of Charles very recently when I was talking with a former professor at Concordia to talk about life. And what we talked about was philosophy and our mutual search for authenticity. Over the last 4 years, I have been caught in a vicious struggle between business and philosophy, a struggle I have passionately been trying to reconcile. Charles's book, The Ascent of Humanity, has been an absolute gift in helping to accelerate this process. He beautifully articulates many of the ideas I was trying to navigate, and he is simply one of the most brilliant I have ever come across. And since reading his book, I've started to take an active role. I've bought dozens of his books to share with friends and family, and I've been working on getting myself more engaged and getting my friends to do the same. And we're getting to the thunderstruck soon. It's going to be a little more dramatic. But due to the tech difficulties. So needless to say, Charles being here today is an extremely fortunate coincidence, and a monotone introduction just wouldn't fit. All right, here we go. So without further ado, Charles Eisenstein graduated from Yale University in 1989 with a degree in philosophy and mathematics. He's a former professor at Penn State. He's a renowned speaker and self-described degrowth activist. He's the author of The Yoga of Eating, Sacred Economics, and The Ascent of Humanity. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in introducing Charles Eisenstein.
There's another reason why. Actually, I was never really a professor at Penn State. I was my official job title was part-time employee, type two. There's one reason maybe that people like to introduce me in a more personal way is that my credentials aren't actually that impressive. I'm not an economist. You know, I'm writing about economics coming from outside the profession, which is an advantage and a disadvantage because it gives me, I'm free of some of the disciplinary blinders that would otherwise prevent me from entertaining certain thoughts. But then again, there's also maybe a little gap here and there in my reasoning. So I was thinking about what Anita was saying about the social entrepreneur, whereas, you know, where she's saying a normal entrepreneur has a business idea, something to sell, and their motivation is to make money, to take something, to maximize their utility, as an economist might put it. Whereas a social entrepreneur isn't motivated to maximize their own financial self-interest. But their motivation is to give something, to contribute something to the community or to the planet, or it's to give something. Now, one might think that those two motivations should be one and the same. After all, if you have something to give that's really valuable to society, then you should be able to make money from that, because money is what people pay for things that are valuable to them, right? If there's something that you want and you're willing to pay for it, that demonstrates that you in fact want it. So why is it not the case that all of the things that we call social entrepreneurship are not also the most financially rewarding activities? That's a question that maybe I'll start with here today. Let's think about, to begin with, what is money? You know, I was thinking, like, when I was thinking about what to talk about today, I was thinking, well, a lot of undergraduates, you know, I mean, maybe some of you guys aren't really interested in economics. And I'm not sure why you're here if you're not, but maybe, like, you know, you just find yourself here. And I'm not going to only talk about economics, but I am going to talk. So I considered talking almost not at all about economics or about money, but then I decided, no, I'm going to mostly talk about money, because really you can't talk about money without talking about everything else too, because money is so central to the way that our culture works and the way that life works. Almost any time that you're looking, if you're 20 years old, 22 years old, you know, and you're looking, you're wondering, what am I going to do with my life? Part of that consideration is probably, how am I going to make a living? Which is the mentality of the normal entrepreneur, right? How am I going to have enough for me? Rather than the mentality of the social entrepreneur, which would be a different way of addressing that question, what am I here to give? What's meaningful to me? What would I like to create with my life? And so the relevance of today's talk to somebody in that situation is to explain maybe why it is that these are two separate questions. Why isn't it that merely by offering what you want to give and expressing your gift that you will be taken care of, that you'll be fine? Why is there this dichotomy? Why is it, in other words, that money is so often, and not all the time, but so often the enemy of what's beautiful to you or what's sacred to you? And by the same token, on a collective level, why is it that we look into the various problems afflicting this planet, deforestation, climate change, nuclear waste, the prison industry, or whatever it is, and we look into these problems and we say, why is that happening? And we dig down a level or two, and the answer is always, somebody's making money off it. Well, why? Why should money be the enemy of the sacred on a personal and a planetary level? Is that just the way money is? Well, what is money? Any economists in the room? Economic students? Amateur? Okay. So I wanted to make sure so that I could tell you my secret. Economists have an answer for what is money. They say it's a medium of exchange, store of value, unit of account. Those were not satisfying to me, because those are kind of more about what money does rather than what it is. Like, what is it that makes something into that? So the answer, well, one answer that I like is Bernard Leiter's answer. Money is an agreement among a community to use something as a medium of exchange. Money is an agreement. I like to say, and here's the secret, what money is. Money is magic. Let me explain what I mean by that. Suppose you were an anthropologist and you visited a primitive, quote-unquote, tribe. I got into trouble by using the word primitive once, even in quotes, because I'm implying a hierarchy with us as the destination. But anyway, you're an anthropologist visiting a primitive tribe, and they're drawing cave paintings and writing mystical symbols on the wall. And you say, why are you doing that? And they say, oh, we are, by drawing these paintings, we are affecting our luck in the hunt. We are bringing the animals to us. And by drawing these symbols here, we are cursing our enemies. And look, if I create this magical talisman, then my enemy in the other tribe will become my slave for life. I could even maybe make somebody kill themselves with this magic. And you would say, well, that's magic, right? That's superstition. You can't actually manipulate symbols and change reality, can you? But in fact, that's exactly what money does. If you are a powerful magician, you can write this mystical script on a piece of paper and use that to cause thousands of people to do your bidding. You can merely by manipulating symbols, you can make a house appear out of nowhere in only a few months. You can, even if you are powerful in this magic, you can make someone your slave for life. In fact, you might be a slave. When you get this thing in the mail, this piece of paper, and on the top it says account balance, and as a result you're ecstatically happy, or you have nearly a heart attack, or maybe because of these symbols, for years. Now we're in Canada here, so like most of you guys don't have this kind of student debt that we have in the States, where like really like people are, one of the people who works with me, she's 46 and is almost done paying off her student debt from undergrad. You know, so really like it can enslave. Okay, so the question here then is, what kind of magic is this? Because it seems like it's a bad magic. It seems like it's making us do things that are destroying the basis of life on Earth, all for money, because of the way these symbols work. So what's gone wrong with it? And not only is it a bad magic, it would seem, it's also a magic that isn't working as well as it used to. Our society is unable to do the things that it was once able to do. Not because the machines don't work anymore, not because people don't know how to use the machines, not because we've stopped advancing technology and can't do as much anymore, but merely because of the way this thing money is working or not working. So for example, this is the issue in the news, right? That tuition is, there's all these protests, and the tuition at McGill is going to rise anyway, and then it seems like you've pressured the government into abandoning that plan, and it comes back again, and why? And the government has their reasons, and the school has their reasons, and all the reasons come down to, well, we just don't have enough money. We're not getting enough from the central government, and the central government has its reasons, not enough money. But money is just an agreement. There's no limit to it. So what's going on here? And that's the question I'd like to discuss a little bit today. What is it that gives magic its power? What is it that gives these symbols their power? Well, it is the agreement that embeds these symbols. The symbols have meaning, and this agreement is, it's a social agreement and a political agreement. And that agreement says who gets to wield these symbols in what way. I actually began investigating money when I first moved back to North America after living abroad, and I went to suburbia. I lived in suburbia, and I had this idea that there was going to be community there. I remembered I remember from when I was a kid, you know, and all the neighbors knew each other and knew what each other's kids were doing, and there were like these stories that kind of held the neighborhood together. Every yard was my yard, except for that mean lady. But aside from that, like, I could go in every yard. You know, if my parents weren't around after school, someone else would take care of me. We could have snacks at each other's houses, you know, and there were always kids outside playing. And I moved back to suburbia in the late 90s, and there wasn't any of that. There were all these houses with young families, but there were no kids outside. And I would just walk through the neighborhood, and there'd be this big playground, empty. And when I was a kid, that would have been packed. Where are all the kids? And then I walk, and there's a blue glow coming from each living room. Maybe it's television. And you see the kids coming out the door, getting into the car, and being driven somewhere to an organized activity somewhere. So maybe the culprit is the automobile and the layout of suburbia. And so I wanted to try to create community. And we tried, like, you know, some kind of cooking circle, you know, and we tried to get neighbors together, but people weren't that interested. And the gatherings were always very superficial, as if people couldn't kind of wait to get away from it. People think, well, I don't really need to be here, you know. And I'm thinking, don't you want community? But eventually I realized that, in fact, they did not need to be there. And that there was no basis for community because we didn't need each other. A community is a group of people who depend on each other's gifts and who, either to survive or to create something larger than themselves. But you don't get community through joint consumption because you really don't need each other. You could do that with anybody. In a money economy, people do not need the people around them. We depend instead on distant strangers. So none of the neighbors in that neighborhood I moved in, unlike when I was a kid and you kind of needed each other to help out on a project maybe, or to help with a plumbing problem, maybe someone would come over and help. And actually, I'm idealizing this a little bit. It wasn't quite that good. But if you went back to the 50s or to the 20s or to a small town or to a village, a medieval village, or to a tribe, okay, then you have people depending on each other for all of the things that make life livable and the things that make life good. And what's happened today in suburbia and in many other contexts progressively is that all of the things that people once did for each other as part of a gift economy have become outsourced and turned into services. So the biggest example is food preparation. Once something that was done inside the family, now in the United States, 2/3 of all meals are prepared outside the home. Supermarket delis, restaurants, things like that. I don't know what it is in Canada, but I bet it's quite high. There are whole neighborhoods in the States where nobody knows how to cook. A lot of the hunger, 1 in 5 or maybe 1 in 7 children in the United States go hungry every night. And it's not because their parents can't afford to buy the food. It's because they don't know how to cook. And so they buy restaurant food, takeout food, prepared food that's actually a lot more expensive than a 40-pound bag of potatoes. So it's a consequence of de-skilling. And that's going to lead me to a whole thing about artificial scarcity. The problem is that this takes hours to really do it right. So I'm just going to touch on a few themes. And the one that really landed on me was community, where we didn't need, you know, we could gather together and I could look at every neighbor and say, I don't need you. I don't need you to sing songs together because I pay for my songs. I don't need you to help me with my plumbing because I'll pay a plumber. I don't need you to watch my children because everyone's paying daycare to do it. I don't need you to create a play, the opportunity for my children to play outdoors because I buy video games for my kids. And even if I wanted to fight that and to resist that, nobody else was wanting to resist that. So I began to wonder, what is it that has driven the conversion of relationships into services. And I discovered it's really the same thing that drives the conversion of nature into product. It has to do with the way that we operate this agreement that we call money. I'll just dive into that. Because really where I'm going with this is to say money is a story. And it's not a story that exists in isolation from all of the other narratives that combine to create the world that we live in today. And this is something that we can sense as we see the gradual breakdown of the story of money. We sense that this breakdown isn't an isolated phenomenon, but that it's connected to all of the other crises and the other things that are breaking down in our society. All of our institutions are in a kind of parallel crisis. So I'll describe how the story of money operates a little bit, and then kind of expand it. Let me explain how the financial system works in a very simplified way that's fundamentally accurate. I'm going to generalize some things. Many people understand today that money is created as debt and as interest-bearing debt. It happens when the Central Bank of Canada purchases a government security of some sort. It basically creates the money to do that just with a few computer keystrokes. Same thing with the Federal Reserve, same thing with the ECB, Bank of Japan. Pretty much every central bank does it this way. They create the money essentially out of thin air. So the person who had the government security now has a positive balance in their account. The same thing happens on the level of commercial banking when a bank lends money to you, maybe for your mortgage. It doesn't take other money from somewhere else and transfer it into your account, but it writes that money into your account. It writes a number into your account. Now there has to be reserves to back it up when a check is written and it clears and stuff like that. I'm not going to go into the details, but let's just say that money is created as debt. And so let's do that right now. Okay? I'm going to lend everybody in this room $1 million. And after 10 years, you have to pay me back $2 million. Okay? But that's fine. In fact, you're happy to do this because you are smart and hardworking. And you're going to take that $1 million, you're going to build a widget factory, and you're going to earn $3 million in 10 years. You're going to pay me back $2 million, and you're going to have $1 million for yourself. Or a chocolate factory, even. Or a daycare center. Or a music company, or something like that. You're going to sell goods and services to the other people in this room. A lumber yard you're going to open and sell lumber. You're going to sell things to other people in this room, and you're going to work harder than everybody else, and you're going to have better ideas, and you're going to easily make that $2 million back. So the system works fine, right? Well, you got made it from somebody else. Right, so right, the problem here is that only half of you can ever pay me back, basically, right? So, and this isn't the whole story, okay, but this is the first step. So from the outset, you're all in competition with each other for not enough money. And living in an atmosphere of scarcity and competition, whether you want to be or not, very much like a game of musical chairs. Now, you can say that the solution, if you look at a certain maybe impoverished community or something like that, you can say the solution is I'm going to teach these people to compete better. And I'm going to go in there with my social entrepreneur skills, and I'm going to make this neighborhood more competitive and keep them in school longer and do all these things, and that's the solution. If we do that everywhere, then everything will be fine. The problem is that somebody always has to be left out. It would be like in the game of musical chairs, you know, where there's always more people than chairs. It's to say, well, the fastest person is getting the chair. So if we teach everybody to run faster, then we will no longer have scarcity of chairs. It doesn't work that way. All right, in the real world, the situations, there's a difference here. Not everybody, after 10 years, half of you don't actually have to go bankrupt. Why? Because by then, I have lent even more money out into the economy. Who do I lend it to? Well, anybody who has a good business plan. Anybody who's going to open a lumber yard, a widget factory, a daycare center, or anything else, any other way to provide goods and services to people. Well, all these new loans come with more interest, right? But that's okay, because by the time that comes due, I will have lent even more money into existence. And so an economist says this is a really good thing. For one thing, that daycare center that you open, that's way more efficient than everybody taking care of their own kids. That lumber yard, you're cutting down those trees that would otherwise have no value, and now they're becoming a product, and you can build bigger houses, and you'll be better off. And it's not a problem as long as you can continue to grow the economy, as long as you can continue to find something that people do for each other, and you can turn that into a service and sell that, or you find something in nature that you can turn into a product and sell that, catch more fish, cut down more trees, extract more oil, and so on. The problem comes when we run out of nature that we can convert into product, and community relationship that we can convert into services. That's what's happening today. Even if we try really, really hard to keep the growth machine going, there's just not that much more room. There's just not that many more forests we can cut down. There's just not that much more atmosphere that we can, atmospheric capacity to absorb our wastes that we can still convert into money. And there's not that many things that people don't pay for already. A few, friendship maybe, you know, so you can become a life coach or something like that, a psychologist, you know, or a professional friend. They actually have professional friend services where you hire this guy to be really like a really cool guy, and he'll come to parties with you and stuff. You can pay for that. In Japan, they have professional relatives too, where really lonely people in old folks' homes, like people come and pretend to be their relatives, you know, and they're paid to do that and keep them company. Yeah. And really, what's happening here is that the dynamic of interest-bearing debt pushes us on an individual and a collective level to find something that can be monetized. Even in the case of Bangladesh, Pakistan, maybe it's your own kidneys. There are whole villages where half the people have only one kidney. And when growth, when the potential for more growth disappears and growth begins to stagnate, the system stops working. Now there's not a lot of good business plans for me to lend you another $1 million. So I stop lending, which means that there's not enough money to pay back the existing debts, and bankruptcies proliferate and the concentration of wealth increases. And that's what's happening today, which is bringing us to a point of breakdown. Now, you can keep it going a little longer by lending more money anyway, even though if I know you're not going to pay me back. And that kind of defers the day of judgment when the system breaks down. And you can do that for a while, and we've been doing that for a while. That's what the housing bubble is, really. I'm not sure how much longer we can do that. We tend to think of very clever ways to hold on to a story that's falling apart. But that's basically what's been going on. And that's why the financial crisis that started in 2008 really hasn't gone away. It's just kind of been shuffled from one place to another to another. And the politicians are saying pretty much they all are in agreement that the way to resolve the crisis would be to somehow get the economy growing again, to stimulate demand, stimulate consumption, because then the system works. Absent that solution, we're stuck. And the story of money that we have today cannot work, which brings us to an intensifying crisis and therefore the opportunity for something completely new, something maybe that's no longer misaligned with what is sacred to us on a personal level and on a planetary level. So I'm going to expand it now a little bit. And just want to keep track of the time. I started about 20 after, so that's still good. Okay. I'm going to expand it a little bit because I also want to get to the solutions. I want to actually describe a little bit of what money does look like if it's aligned with a new set of narratives. So the story that we call money is embedded in larger stories that are so deeply woven into our civilization that you could really call them myths. And there's two of them that I'll name right now. One of them you could call the story of the self, and the other you could call the story of the people, or the story of the world. Every culture has these myths or stories that answer really fundamental questions, such as, who am I? Why am I here? What's important? How does the universe work? How do things change? What's the nature of causality? Why do things happen? Who are we as a species? What is a human being? Where do we come from and where are we going? Most cultures take their answers to these questions as just reality, not seeing them as a myth. And our culture is the same. So the answers that we've lived in for a long time now, and I'm simplifying this, right? This is really the dominant narrative, but it's not the exclusive narrative. And there's always been a counter narrative that's occasionally flowered into human affairs, and that's always there under the surface. Okay, so I'm deliberately simplifying things, realizing I'm in an academic setting. I want to put that disclaimer out there, and also understanding that meta-historical narratives like this are not in vogue. Anyway, so okay. The story of the self answers the questions like this. It says, who you are is a discrete, separate individual among other individuals, other selves, in a world that's also separate from you. Like, who are you? Well, yeah, here I am. This is me, right? I'm not this. I'm not you. I'm not the trees. Maybe I depend on the trees to maintain the homeostasis of the biosphere, but I am not them. We're just we're separate individuals depending on each other, but I am not them. I am not you. I'm separate. I'm this bubble of psychology inside of a flesh robot walking around. I am an economic man seeking to maximize my rational self-interest. I am the expression of my DNA that programs me to maximize reproductive self-interest. I am a conglomeration of masses operating according to the forces of physics, the laws of physics. I am, if I'm religious, I am a soul encased in flesh. If I'm a philosopher, I'm a mote of consciousness, again, inside a flesh robot, right? All of these different realms of human inquiry kind of agree on what a self is. And this is becoming obsolete today, but it still dominates our institutions come from this understanding of what a self is. And so in this understanding, it's certainly true that more for you is less for me, that the more resources you control, the less that I control. And that in this external world, security comes through control, comes through having a lot of force at your disposal. So you can see how already this story kind of contains the story of money, because the story of money separates us. Everybody owes me $2 million, everybody has $1 million. It puts you into competition with each other. And somebody else, somebody in this room gets sick, well, they won't be able to compete as well. So that's to your advantage. It's very different than it was in an ancient gift economy, which was every economy, really, before there was money, where if you had more than you needed, you would share it. Because possessions were a burden, for one thing, if you're a hunter-gatherer, or even if you're a farmer, you know, the grain is going to decay, it's going to go bad. Much better to share it and generate goodwill in your tribe, in your community. And then if you get sick, all of the people who you gave to, they'll take care of you too. There'll be a lot of goodwill. So wealth is a matter of generosity, and it's a living reality that what you do to the other, you are doing to yourself. That was a living reality that economic life reinforced. Whereas today, economic life doesn't reinforce that. You know, you give to charity and that money's gone. It doesn't help you. You choose a career path that is in service. It's an act of nobility, it's an act of generosity. And you know, you become a social worker and you make very little money. You try to protect wetlands or something like that, you know. You start a permaculture farm, right? Like, you act in service, and you don't get taken care of. So our economic life contradicts spiritual teachings that say we're all one. But economic life didn't used to contradict that, okay? And so what I'm saying here is that our economic life, our money system, is part of this larger story. It reifies it. Another part of the larger story, the story of the people, what is a human being? What is humanity's purpose here? You know, where do we come from? It says that, well, we started out as naked, helpless animals, but thanks to our big brains and our hands, we developed science, we developed technology, we became gradually over time the lords and possessors of nature, transcending natural limitations, harnessing natural forces, domesticating the wild. And someday, the story says, our triumph will be complete. We will transcend nature entirely. We will go off into space. We will synthesize food. We will upload our consciousness into computers. We'll live in bubble cities, separate from nature, like in the Jetsons, where there's nothing alive. And we'll conquer all disease. Right? We'll win this war against nature finally, once and for all. That's kind of and you can tell this is an obsolete story. But again, money, the way it works today, because it compels growth, it compels the conversion of nature into product, into property, it is also part of this story. And this story is breaking down on every level. The idea of utopia through control, through science, through applying the methods of science to every realm, isn't working very well anymore, if it ever did work. Social engineering, engineering poverty out of existence, the war against disease. None of these things are bringing the results that they once did in the 50s, it seemed, in the 60s, when these stories were more robust. And just intuitively, we don't resonate with them anymore either. Conquest of nature. You didn't used to have to apologize if you were enacting the conquest of nature. You were a hero. There was no negative cachet to that phrase. Today, there's at least greenwashing. You know, at least like you have to like make excuses for chopping down the forests. But back a couple generations ago, it's like, yeah, you know, You're a captain of industry. So the stories are breaking down, and on a scientific level too. This idea of separate selves in an external Cartesian universe has been obsolete for 90 years. The subject-object distinction has been breaking down in physics, in anthropology, in biology, in psychology. I could go into any of these fields and talk about that. The self as a social construct, the prevalence of symbiosis and horizontal gene transfer in biology. And any of these fields are undergoing kind of these slow motion paradigm shifts, and there's a lot of resistance to those. But anyway, so basically what we are living through right now is a transition in the defining stories of our civilization, the story of the self and the story of the world. And as that transition proceeds, the institutions built on these old stories begin to crumble. They have a lot of momentum. They're still here, and they still dominate. So if you personally no longer resonate with the story of separation and the story of the ascent of humanity and the conquest of nature, then you're going to have trouble finding a job. Because the economic system is built on the old stories. If your life passion isn't to convert nature into product and isn't to find something that people do for themselves and each other, take it away and sell it back somehow, but then you're going to have trouble finding a job, because that's where the money comes from. You know, if your business plan is, Charles, I am going to teach people reskilling, to cook for themselves anymore, to start cooking for themselves, well, what are you going to sell? And the people who want to do that, they're moving away from money. You know, there's not a lot of business opportunity in those things. Maybe a little bit, but not as much as in, and nobody does this consciously, but it's almost conscious, not as much money to be made as in finding, you know, let's sell prepackaged Thanksgiving meals so that people don't have to cook Thanksgiving. Well, you guys are in Canada, but you don't do the whole turkey thing. But you do. Okay. Well, you know what I'm talking about, right? This hit me when I was living in Taiwan, and I saw a TV commercial with this, like, you know, old grandmother. Like, Chinese New Year is the big thing, and there's all these traditional dishes, you know, and the commercial said, now grandma doesn't have to work so hard, because 7-Eleven has all of the New Year's favorites. You know, you just go buy those things, right? There's an opportunity. You take something away and you sell it back. That's a business plan that's always worked and can still work if you're here to learn a new business plan. So basically, if that's not your life's passion, then you have a little problem, because mostly, and there's a lot of exceptions, okay, because the system doesn't work perfectly, but mostly where the money is for the people who are most efficient and most effective in converting nature into product and relationship into services. And if that's not your passion, then you're not going to make a lot of money. Until we move into a new story of money that is built on a new story of the self and a new story of the people, a new mythology. And what would that be? Obviously, the new story of the self is the connected self, the self of interbeing. Interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, where it's not just that we depend on each other, it's that we are each other in some sense. It's the feeling of here's the same being looking out from different eyes. It's the feeling that we all get, I think, when we witness something horrible happening, or a species extinction, or something like that, or a forest being knocked down, or you look at the devastation wrought by the tar sands mining, and it hurts. You know? It hurts. Why does that hurt? Is there an unconscious, rational calculation that my self-interest will be damaged because there will be fewer medicines obtained from the extinct species in that rainforest? Is that really what's going on? Or is it hurting because it's happening to you? And that's something you can feel. I think that's why it's hurting. But we've lived in a story of the world that obscures that knowledge. And that story is falling apart. And as we step into a story of inner being that validates and provides a logical framework for our understanding of our felt connection to other beings, then no longer does the mind have to conflict with the logic of the heart. And they can come into alignment. This story of inner being is being elaborated in many, many fields. In ecology, for example. Even in physics. A lot of the new scientific paradigms that embody inner being are still considered unorthodox, even pseudoscience. But they are unstoppable, especially as the technologies based on the old paradigms have become less and less effective. The new story of the people is no longer rising to become lords and masters of nature, but being co-creative partners in the unfolding of nature. It says that human beings, and it mirrors the new story of the self, we're not separate from nature, humanity, but we're part of ecology. We are like every other species on Earth, that we have a gift to give toward the well-being and development of the whole. Not separate and above. A new understanding. Scientists just a couple generations ago said, oh, not all beings have a role to play in the maintenance of the whole. Some species are harmful. Others are beneficial. And if we remove the harmful species, then Earth will be better off. We didn't understand that nature and ecology is a gift network. Just like in an ancient tribe where any one person dies or is incapacitated, everybody is poorer. And that's the way an ecosystem is too. Any one species disappears, everybody's a little weaker. We're starting to understand that now. And the next step is to apply it to ourselves and say, what is our purpose? And this is, again, mirroring the social entrepreneur. Well, what is our purpose? What are we here to give? How can we participate in the resiliency and the health of the community of all life on Earth? That's the new story of the people. At the beginning, I think it'll be just to heal the damage that's been done over millennia of separation. And there are people developing these technologies right now. Very little money in these technologies, in regenerative agriculture, in the technologies that like are that can green deserts. Amazing things that people can do. The bioremediation of toxic waste. Some of these things are a little off the radar screen even. But these are the technologies of reunion. And there's no money in them right now. But there will be when money embodies a new story. So, there's two things I can do right now. What are people more hungry for at the moment? I could either elaborate on this transition process from the old story to the new story, how it happens on a cultural and individual level, which is personally relevant to a lot of people here, or I could describe what a money system would look like that embodied the new stories that were consistent with an ecological economy. All right. All right. I'll do a couple. I'll do a little bit of the second one first. Then there's a few different things Maybe I'll start with, I'll kind of list them, and then I'll describe one or two of them in more detail. And these are kind of the pillars of sacred economics. Sacred meaning in alignment with the things that are becoming sacred to us, in alignment with the story of inner being, of co-creative partnership on Earth. So they would be the internalization of external costs, the backing of money with the commons and the restoration of the commons, a system based on negative interest, the localization of many or even most economic functions, the development of a gift economy, which is already growing, and I guess this is related to some of the other ones, but a shift of taxation away from income and transactions and toward resources and economic rents and pollution. Okay, so those are some of the pieces of it, and I mentioned them just, I'm listing them just in case people who are well-read in this area can ring a few bells. And so maybe I'll talk a little bit about one of the more unfamiliar ones. Oh, the other one, important, is a universal basic income, a social dividend. Not familiar? Basically, this is actually starting to grow as a movement in Europe. A universal basic income is essentially an annual income given to every citizen that you don't have to earn. You just get it. Well, could we really afford that? And what would happen if we weren't motivated by money? Like, what would happen if you didn't have to work? Economists say that would be a catastrophe. Because everybody knows, they say, that you don't really want to work. I know you, they say. If you had a guaranteed basic income, you'd just sit on your butt in front of the TV eating chocolate bonbons. Because I know you. All you want to do is to maximize your reproductive self-interest or your utility. And if you're guaranteed, your survival is guaranteed and your basic life needs are guaranteed, then why would you bestir yourself from in front of your television? So there's a view of human nature under this. Now, I think that, in fact, human nature is not to take and secure as much as possible. If you've been in a situation where you are absolutely financially secure, but you're not doing something meaningful to you, you know what a hell that is, how dissatisfying it is, and how at some point you can't stand it anymore and you'll throw it all away to find your purpose. So I think a little introspection can demolish the economic doctrine of the disutility of work. We are creative beings. And in fact, it's kind of the opposite of what economists say. Very often, it's the pressure to make a living and to survive that suppresses our creativity and or directs our creativity toward things that don't actually serve society and the planet. And that leads to this tension between the social entrepreneur and the normal entrepreneur. Where, I mean, everybody's probably got a little bit of both, you know? And why are the decisions that benefit the community so often? I mean, we'd like to pretend otherwise, that it always works out. If you make the best environmental decision or the best community decision, it'll also redound to your bottom line. We'd like to you know, have this conflict disappear, but it doesn't. At some point, there's always a compromise to make. Shall I make a little bit more money, or shall I do what's right? Okay. How do I get to that? Yes, universal basic income. Right. So basically, it allows our creativity to naturally express itself. And maybe some people will do things that earn money and some people won't. Some things that this planet needs and that society needs will never be made into products, will never be commodified, will never be quantified. We have a system that that encourages the growth of the quantitative, of what can be counted and measured, and neglects the things that cannot be. So we've become richer than any society ever on Earth in terms of the things that can be measured, but poorer in terms of the things that cannot be measured, or that are hard to measure, or that we don't bother to measure. Some of them can't be measured. Intimacy. Connection. The feeling of belonging in this universe and being embedded in a nurturing matrix of relationships. Beauty. You know, Montreal is quite beautiful, but I drive around Harrisburg and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, after 5,000 years of architectural development, this is the best we can do? I just like one ugly building after another, you know? How have we become so poor? Well, we're actually richer than ever in terms of square meters per capita. But we've become poorer in the things we can't measure. Okay. I'll talk a little bit about negative interest. So say I have200 loaves of bread right now, and I'm a selfish bastard. If I could, I'd keep them all for myself and eat them all, but I can't, because I can't eat that much bread, and in a couple days it's going to be stale. So being the selfish bastard that I am, what am I going to do? Well, one thing I could do is I could give everybody in this room 2 loaves of bread. Nice fresh bread. Here you are. And why is that to my self-interest? Well, it does me no good to sit on them, but my generosity is going to create gratitude, and or I could even say, when I'm hungry, I want those 2 loaves back, 2 fresh loaves of bread back. Okay. The reason that it's not in my self-interest to hoard the bread is because the bread goes bad. Well, money is not like that. Money is different from pretty much everything else in the universe. It doesn't decay with time. It doesn't obey the law of impermanence. It doesn't return to its source. But if you have it, you can grow it, especially if you have a lot of it. If you have a lot of it, you can make an income from the money that exceeds the rate of inflation. And so why should I share my money? Why should I let you use it when I'm not using it? I can keep it instead. Well, so the idea then is to subject money to a decay rate, kind of the opposite of interest. And it would take the form of a liquidity tax on bank reserves. So here I am, a bank. I have $10 billion. And it's losing 5% a year as reserves in the Bank of Canada. So now it's to my interest, to my financial self-interest, to lend it at zero interest. Because then it's not going to decay at 5% anymore. So it allows lending to happen even in an economy that's not growing. Even if your best business plan is going to be that, you know, a pretty good guarantee of paying me back with no interest, like that's a good enough business plan. So it allows credit to circulate in a zero growth environment. It also reverses the discounting of future cash flows. So what I mean by that is today, if you own a forest and you have to decide, do I cut down the whole forest right now for $100 million, or do I log it sustainably for $1 million a year forever? Well, it's to your financial interest to cut it down right now and pave it over and make that $100 million, because you can make more than $1 million a year on the interest. And this economic logic, it happens. I read an account, I think it was by William Grider, of a Malaysian minister of finance, who said, yes, we should cut down all of our country's forests, because when we liquidate that capital and invest that money in interest-bearing securities, we're going to make more than we could make by sustainably logging the forests. Like, this actually happens. Well, if money decays, then you would much rather keep the forest there and make $1 million a year forever. So I'm not going to get too much into the details. It sounds, at first glance, like somewhat of a half-baked idea, and various objections come to mind, like wouldn't it stimulate inflation or overconsumption? If you knew your money was going to decay, wouldn't you just go out and spend it all and consume? Again, that taps into a certain view of human nature as being profligate, and I'm not going to go into that whole thing, but I just want to say that the book lays out the dynamics of negative interest, how banking would work, how capital would accumulate, and all that. It lays it out in a lot more detail. And there's a lot of serious economists, like real economists with credentials, who have explored this idea. Even John Maynard Keynes wrote sympathetically of it. So and it's almost happening. It's almost wanting to happen. As central bankers complain about the zero lower bound that neuters monetary policy, that you can stimulate growth by lowering interest rates, but you can't lower them below zero. Well, what if you could? So anyway, that's maybe a slightly more geeky dimension to this. And I want to leave time for questions and answers. So let me just say one little bit about one thing that's slightly holding me back is like people keep coming up and saying, oh, I've seen you on YouTube. And I'm like, okay, what have people already heard? But I'll just say one little thing about this transition. Because, obviously, negative interest, universal basic income, green taxes, all these other things that I write about, they're really not on the radar screen politically right now. It's going to take a pretty big breakdown for them to happen. The solutions and the policies that are on the radar screen today have to be exposed by events as bankrupt before anything new will be politically acceptable. So this process of collapse is a key part of a transition from an old story to a new story. And it's true in personal life, too. Like, how often do you make a really, really big change in your life when the way you've been living is working pretty darn well? Right? Not very often. You might think, it's unsustainable. I've got to stop living on credit. I've got to stop drinking or whatever. But until that breakdown actually happens, you're probably going to keep doing it. And that's how our society works, too. And that breakdown is starting to happen. And this, in a way, it's very similar to the archetype of transition, which would be birth or death or coming of age. Any major transition works in a slightly similar way. The old world falls apart, then you're in an empty space in between where you don't know what's real anymore. You don't know what to believe, what to think, and then a new story can be born. So one of the things I write about in my new book, it's despair. And sometimes you look at the human condition and at humanity, and you say, we're just nature's big mistake. No other species does what we're doing. This violence, this destruction. Earth would be much better off without us. We're like a cancer that grows and grows, takes and takes, grows exponentially. And then we'll have to crash. We're acting as if we're an exception to nature. It's a very compelling narrative. It sure seems that way. But there's actually another situation in nature where you have exponential growth. Many situations. An immature ecosystem, for example. The biomass of an immature ecosystem grows exponentially, and the plants compete with each other for sunlight and soil. And then, when that phase is over, then the exponential growth levels off, and it reaches a steady state, and it becomes much more symbiotic, and the relationships among different species become much more complex. Another situation where there's rapid growth approaching maturity and then a leveling off of growth is childhood. And humanity is very much like a child. A child takes and takes and takes from the mother and from the father, receives, and it's not the child's responsibility to give back. I'm happy for my children to receive from me fully. I don't want them to restrain themselves to eat less because they're worried about dad making enough money or something like that. That's not their job. They're supposed to receive and they're supposed to grow. And then when they grow, when that growth reaches a certain point, it begins to slow down. And that's the point our civilization is reaching. We're already seeing it. Economic growth slowing down, population growth slowing down, really leveling off in this century. Is that a problem? Like, is it a problem that my 16-year-old son isn't growing anymore? Like, should I, you know, try to stimulate growth? He's already 190 centimeters. Like, that would be insane, wouldn't it? And in a similar way, it's insane to try to squeeze more growth out of our planet, out of our civilization, when what's happening is that we're reaching adulthood. We're entering a transition into adulthood. And how do I know that? There's two things. One is that the love relationship changes when you enter adulthood. You still have the parental love where you receive, but then a new kind of love happens where you want to give as well as to receive, romantic love, and where you're no longer just taken, but you want to even create together. And you want to give a gift to your sweetie, right? And if you only want to receive, then everybody recognizes you as just like a big baby and not ready for, you know that person probably. So humanity is now entering the stage, and we began to enter it as a mass phenomenon. I mean, certainly there were people who were way ahead of their time, but as a culture, we began to enter it in the 60s. And there was that film that's been going around recently about the astronauts and the photos of Earth that they beamed down. Does anyone see that? Overview, is it called? You know, like the impact of that image was so powerful. The astronauts had spiritual experiences and people fell in love with this planet. The environmental movement was born around that time. And we no longer saw nature as just this endless resource from which we could take. We began to mature. We still, now again, our systems, our institutions are still grounded in an old paradigm. They don't yet reflect the necessity to give as we receive. That's the part about internalizing external costs, internalizing ecological costs that I didn't really get into. So we have to bring economy into alignment with this new relationship to Earth. But we fell in love with Earth at this time. And the second thing that happens is a coming-of-age ordeal. Ancient people knew this. They would take you out when you approached the age of adulthood. They would take you out and subject you to an ordeal that made your world fall apart. Everything that had seemed so certain and secure and sure, and even who you thought you were, was no longer relevant when you were tied to that tree without food and water for 3 days until you had a vision, or fed psychedelic plants, or subjected to circumcision with a rock, or whatever else it was that locked in a hut and the elders pounding drums all the time, like whatever it was going on in your vision quest, right? Like your identity molted, your identity fell apart, and you then were able to take on a larger identity as a full member of the tribe, and you would come back from that as a full member of the tribe, and everybody would know you were an adult, and you wouldn't, as in our society, walk around in your 20s and your 30s and your 40s thinking, I'm an adult playing grown-up here. Who am I fooling? Adult clothes, adult body, but I feel like I'm playing grown-up. Why? It's maybe because we haven't fully gone through that coming-of-age ordeal. Humanity is going through it now. All of the things that seem so sure, even our notion of what reality is, falling apart. And initiating us into full membership of the tribe of all life on Earth. Okay. Thank you.
I don't know about any of you, but I wouldn't be able to process a question right now. My mind is racing. And in all the good ways, I think. Obviously, that was a wonderful talk. I think we're all feeling a little bit energetic, a little bit inspired, and we would like to open it up now. We have a couple of microphones. We'd ask if you have a question to just raise your hand and stand up, and one of myself, either myself or my colleague, Ron, will bring you the microphone, and we'll try to do this as efficiently as possible.
Can we add... Also, to give space for undergraduates to ask questions too. Okay?
Please.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
All right. Good point.
We pay lip service to universality of rights and equality, but we don't really believe in it, neither do we practice it. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the poverty, the injustice, all the other troubles we have. We make distinctions based on race and gender and age and wealth and all kinds of things because we define ourselves by our material possessions, unfortunately. Now, admittedly, it's creating a mess, but I would suggest that as the situation gets worse, the race is going to become more frenetic rather than less. So unless you are the magician that can rival the magic of money, I don't see the positive signs that you're talking about. I see the disintegration, I see the problems, but I don't see the optimism, so I would appreciate if you could perhaps support the optimism a little better.
It's obvious that there's a breakdown happening, and you're saying that how do we know on the other side of this breakdown there's any kind of renaissance, any kind of paradigm shift, any kind of transition into a different mythology? I can't prove it to you that this is going to happen, but let me tell you where my optimism comes from. My optimism comes from seeing how human beings, well, there's a few sources. Let me just mention, have you read, there's a book by Rebecca Solnit called A Paradise Built in Hell. And she investigates, and it's a very scholarly book, well, semi-scholarly book. She investigates how people actually do respond when everything falls apart. So she examined a lot of historical cases. For example, the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, the explosion of the munitions ship in Halifax, I believe it was, in 1917, something like that, Katrina, a bunch of different things. And what happens is that very, very quickly, people begin to take care of each other. It's not like you would think, or that we're conditioned to think that it's a war of all against all and social chaos and rioting and Often the only rioting that happens is by the police themselves. But what happens is that very, very quickly, self-emergent structures of solidarity and mutual caretaking arise. Right. Absolutely. That's because the outside that disaster area, all of the structures of control are still intact. So they come in and they dismantle the self-created structures that people are building in the disaster area. The army comes in, the police come in, and they say, "I'm sorry, you can't have that soup kitchen there anymore." So there's because outside the disaster area, the old story is still going strong. What happens when the disintegration happens on such a mass scale that there is no the powers that were don't have the ability to do that anymore? But I think that the collapse has to be that profound, and it really comes down to what's human nature, you know? But you could read that book. I don't think that it's going to address the fundamental sense of despair. I agree that it's going to take a miracle to substantially change the way we live on this planet. What's a miracle? A miracle is something that is impossible from an old story of the world, impossible from a new one. And I witness miracles happening. And I hesitate to bring some of them in because I don't want to seem like a crackpot. But, my whole life, I've experienced things that told me that what I thought was real and possible is only a very narrow subset of what's actually real and possible, both on a material level and on kind of a social level, you know? So, it could be, I go to this healing center where they have a video of this guy who they worked on for a couple of years who had a severed spinal cord and was paralyzed from the chest down. And there was absolutely no possibility that he would ever walk again. But they actually regrew his spinal cord using hands-on therapy. Now, could I prove to you that that's actually what happened, that it wasn't some kind of hoax? No, I can't prove it to you. When I was in Taiwan, this is going to take a long time. Let's just say, let me tell you the story of, this is what I got from a book by Andrew Harvey called The Hope. And it's from the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa. And a case was brought up, those committees brought together the victims of apartheid and the perpetrators. And here's a situation where it would take a miracle for the violence that was perpetrated on the blacks not to be carried forth into the future in the form of revenge and genocide, tribalism, a mess, right? Like, the amount of damage, the amount of suffering, the amount of hate, the amount of trauma that went down there, any reasonable person would expect that to be carried on, just as any reasonable person would expect that there could be no peace in Israel and Palestine in any foreseeable future. A woman an elderly black woman from the ghetto was put face to face with a policeman, Mr. Vandenbroek, who had tortured and murdered her husband and her only son in front of her eyes a number of years before. And he confessed to it. The evidence was irrefutable. And the court asked, or the committee asked the woman, the old woman, what would you like to see happen to feel that justice has been done? And she said, I would like three things. I have three requests, she said. The first is that I would like to be taken to where the remains of my family are, so I can give them a proper burial. My second request said, I really want Mr. Vanderbroek to know that he's forgiven. Because that's what my husband would have wanted. And that's what my religion teaches, forgiveness, for real. And my third request, she said, you know, that was my only family, and I have so much love to give, and no one to give it to. And so I would request that Mr. Vanderbroek agree that I adopt him as my son and come visit me in the ghetto every month so that I can pour out the love that I have onto him. Mr. Vanderbroek apparently fainted in the courtroom because this was something that was a miracle. It's something that did not fit into his story of the world. So it doesn't necessarily have to violate the laws of physics as we understand them, although there are a lot of what I would call technologies of reunion that do violate what we understand about the way that the world works on one level or another. But without those, it is indeed hopeless. Without social and material miracles, it is indeed hopeless.
So you were speaking about magic, and I wanted to know how seriously you wanted me to take that when you started off the debate with it. And from my understanding, magic is action at a distance. And when I looked into the thing that you keep referring to as money, well, in the Kabbalistic terms, money is a deity of prosperity, and its attributes are greed and control. So to climb the Kabbalist tree of life, you must first encounter money. And also, I wanted to know that if you are consciously aware of this magic, does it still affect you?
Okay. Well, maybe I'm not going to go so much into the Kabbalistic stuff. Because money can be something very different. You know, really what money is supposed to be, maybe it's never really been this, but what it's supposed to be is a token of gratitude. It says, you've done something for me. You've given me something, and I don't have anything to give you. I don't have anything you need, but here's a shiny, useless thing instead. And it shows that I appreciate what you've done. And next time somebody does something for you and you don't know what to do for them, you can give them this shiny thing. Like on a really naive level, that's what money's supposed to be. Sometimes people ask if I envision a society without money, and I don't think so. I think we have to have some way to coordinate human labor and the flow of resources over a vast scale, over vast social distances. It's kind of like a signaling molecule in the body that directs resources to where they're needed. Okay. As for whether seeing through the magic of money makes you less affected by it, absolutely. Like, I know a bunch of people who live totally without money. Mark Boyle is a friend of mine in England. He wrote a book called The Moneyless Manifesto. It's really quite good. People keep sending me links. Like, there's a family of three who lives without money. I get letters from people, too, sometimes. They read my book, and they say, I've read your book, and I've given away all my money. And I'm like, oh, shit, you know. But if you're doing it to prove yourself to be a really good, noble person, then that's what you will get. You will get thinking that you're a good, noble person and no money. But if it's really an act of liberation. And so I get these letters, and you know, I gave away all my money, and you will not believe the wealth that has come into my life since I've done that. The wealth that was waiting there to happen since I've done that. And I've gotten quite a number of letters like that from people. I could tell you another story. But yeah, and then there's the whole movement of getting off the money grid, you know. defaulting on your debts, you know, and just forgetting it all and living under the table. And I mean, I know a lot of people who live on, well, not a lot, but I mean, I know people who live very, very well on $5,000 a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a place for control, maybe. Greed, I think, is, I mean, it's just that we take this, it's just like reason or patriarchy or any of these other little things, you know, we take them and apply them way beyond their proper scope. Hierarchy, you know, like hierarchy maybe has a place in this world. I don't know, like some of those tribal men's societies where they have these really involved rituals and stuff, and it's all really not even that relevant to the life of the tribe. You know, it's like this big game. Like maybe hierarchy is a place in games or dramas that we enact. I don't know. Anyway, we apply it beyond its proper scope, and it usurps other ways of being, other ways of knowing. So control is like that too, or maybe, or greed. I don't, well, let's have another question.
Last question, sorry.
First of all, thank you for a fantastic talk. I'd like to ask you, you've kind of covered things in a big picture kind of way, and I'd like to know how you imagine this new economy or next economy, what it looks like on the ground level. In particular, I know that you've done gift circle experiments.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear about that.
Yeah. So I think that there's a necessity for action on many levels. The stuff about negative interest, right? That's like on a global or national level. Then there's a lot of the personal stuff of letting go of the mentality of money, the mentality of scarcity. Then there's the intermediate level of community. And I think that's what you're asking about. So there's all kinds of stuff, you know, gift circles, time banks, lending libraries, where it's not just books, but you have some neighborhood center where you have a shed full of tools, all kinds of things that people don't use very often. And today, maybe every household has its own set of power tools, which they use, you know, 5 hours a year. Well, you could share those in the whole neighborhood and have just one or two sets of them. So the sharing economy, I think, it's already growing even against the tide of the money system. And as the money system works less and less well, the sharing economy will grow faster and faster. It's already happening in Greece and Portugal. There's really interesting experiments, you know, of what are the other ways people can use to meet each other's needs. And in Canada, you don't have the economic necessity to do it yet. But it's really useful to begin to create the seeds for that and the habits for that and the you know, prototypes for other ways of doing it. And so any way that you're sharing things that doesn't necessitate money as the medium of exchange, like file sharing online, like, you know, pirating software and giving it to your friends. Social media is a good means to do that. It's really easy for digital goods. But for material goods, then you have to do things on a local level. Is that it's a bit vague, but yeah. All right, so we're pretty much done then, huh?
Yeah, I think we should all take a moment first and thank Charles again. I mean, I feel very fortunate to have been able to work on this with Anita, to be able to bring this to the McGill community and to the Montreal community. It justifies my work, even though I'm going to have inner conflicting thoughts about my salary and all these kinds of things. But I'll get over it. You know, I'll work that through. We have a small thank you for Charles here. And I'm going to go against the trend a little bit here, Charles, and actually ask you to open it here in front of everyone, okay. If you would just take a moment. Oh, he got the context.
Yeah. Ah. Aww.
So, yes, there is a new addition to Charles's family. His wife and Charles, they welcomed their fourth child earlier this month.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I want to say one more little thing. All right.
Sure.
Just, I know I haven't provided a rigorous case for anything here. I've told kind of a big story, and it's meant to be kind of provocative. One of the things I'm writing about in my new book is the idea that we don't actually form our beliefs the way we think we do, based on evidence and logic. But rather, usually we use evidence and logic as tools to flesh out the beliefs that we already have. So, and what really generates beliefs, it's really a state of being. And there's always an emotional component to that. So, as you leave and kind of work with some of these ideas in your head, pay attention to how they feel and to what emotions come up as you entertain the idea that, for example, that the crises that are converging upon us today are a birth crisis propelling us into a new age. Like, what does that bring up? Does it bring up, like, this kind of derisive cynicism? Like, and if so, that is a window to a state of being that has suffered a lot of hurt. You know, we are born believing, knowing that the world is supposed to be much more beautiful than what's been offered to us as normal. It's not supposed to be this way. You're not supposed to hate Monday. We have this knowledge. It's not supposed to be this ugly. It's not supposed to be this inauthentic. You know, we know that life in the world is supposed to be a lot more beautiful. And that knowledge gets betrayed and betrayed and betrayed again and again and again. And one way we respond is by developing this cynical protective layer against ever really hoping, lest we be betrayed again. So I'll just ask you to pay attention to the emotional components of the different beliefs that are offering themselves to you. Okay? That's my takeaway. So thank you again. And yeah.
That Anita and I tried to do was think of ways that we could stay in line with the message you'd be hearing today when it came to the cocktail in particular that's coming up. And you're going to have the opportunity to taste some wonderful finger foods upstairs on the second floor where the cocktail is being held. And it's being provided by Robin des Bois, which is a really unique kind of restaurant here in Montreal. It's almost completely operated by volunteers. All the profits go back into the community. So, you know, I'm sure the founder of that restaurant is not exactly running on the same kind of salary and things like that as Gordon Ramsay, let's say. And what I'd like to do is just ask you to bear with us for two more minutes. And I'm going to invite George up from Robin des Bois just to talk a little bit about it, because I think it is important for us to know what's happening here in our community. So, George.
Salut tout le monde. Hello, everyone. So upstairs we have finger foods, as you said, and I'm going to do this fast because the food is already there and waiting for you. It comes from Robin des Bois, which is a restaurant located, for those that don't know, in St. Lawrence Street between Saint-Joseph and Mont-Royal. So the restaurant is special because, first of all the profits go to a local charity. All the profits are divided by four, and the four organizations are Le Chénon, Centre Paul Roulin, Son Youth, and Le Refuge des Jeunes. So another thing, it's like we work a lot with volunteers. So we have a real restaurant with two chefs and a kitchen staff. And at the dinner, at the dining room, let's say, we have a small staff, which I'm working as a manager. We have two managers and only one waiter and two barmen. So we have volunteers that come every day around 12 to 16, help us. They go to the kitchen, they do things for the cooks. And in the dining room, they serve the people. So That's it. You can always come by and feel the vibe of the restaurant, or go to the website robindubois.ca. It's from there that the volunteers reserve their place and come to see us. You don't have to reserve for a lot of days. Just one time is okay. 5 hours maximum, one day. So you're always welcome. We need people. And that's a particular restaurant because the food they prepare, when we have volunteers that we don't pay in the kitchen, so almost everything is homemade. Things you cannot do in other restaurants. And the food is very nice. Voilà. Merci. Thank you, George.
What good is food without beverage? And so I'd like to thank our other two sponsors who are providing the beverages this evening. Once again, it's on the second floor. You need your ticket to get into the cocktail. Books will be for sale, and Charles has agreed to make himself available for some signings. And enjoy the evening. Thank you again so much for coming, everyone.